Well, welcome to On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headley. Some Atlanta officials may have taken bribes to award multi-million dollar business contracts. Two contractors pleaded guilty to paying these bribes. So we've covered the story since February, and new developments have come to light. Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Scott Truby has been covering the bribery scandal, and he joins me now to make some sense of it. Scott, this is so dense. You are trying to put together pieces to a puzzle, aren't you?
Yes.
So talk to us about your reporting that appeared in Sunday's Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Sure. We obtained some bank records related to E.R. Mitchell, who is one of the key figures in the bribery scheme.
And who is he?
He's an Atlanta contractor. He's been around the city for a long time, done contracting for the city of Atlanta, for APS, for Fulton County Schools, DeKalb Schools. He's been around a long time.
Okay.
And so, anyway, we obtained some bank records of his from 2013 to 2015 and found that he and his companies had written checks or wired money to companies tied to Reverend Mitzi Bickers to the tune of $1.6 million. These payments, we don't exactly know what these payments were for, but we can say that there's one payment, a wire transfer on April 1st, 2014, for $110,000. That matches what E.R. Mitchell pleaded guilty to, which he described as a bribe, as a wire payment for a bribe to obtain a city contract. It's the only wire for $110,000 on that day that we are aware of, and it seems to match the federal probe.
And who is Mitzi Bickers?
Reverend Bickers is a well-known Atlanta political operative. She once was the president of the Atlanta School Board. She once ran for Fulton County Commission Chairman. She also helped Kasim Reed's bid in 2009 to become mayor. She led a get-out-the-vote effort. And then after Mr. Reed was elected, she became his director of human services and served in that role from 2010 to the first part of 2013.
The money trail is really at the heart of this, right? And that's what you're trying to get to the root of, the bottom of at this point, right?
Yes, it is.
The answers will be there. Is that fair to say?
We think a lot of the answers will be there. Now, what we have is a narrow picture. We don't have the full picture of what was going on. And we are still trying to get to the bottom of this.
And Mr. Mitchell has told his story. Is he cooperating with the investigation at this point? He's pleaded guilty.
Yes, he has pleaded guilty in exchange for a lenient sentence. He has offered his full cooperation to the feds. You might say he will essentially be a star witness for the feds.
What is your sense of, because you've got a lot of numbers in this piece, and one of the things you have to do, Scott, is what prosecutors ultimately have to do, which is to tell a very complex story in a simple way.
Yes.
What's the line you're following now? What's the kind of narrative line you're following in the story?
Gosh. Well, what we're trying to do is find out, what contracts E.R. Mitchell got, which we've reported on that. He got snow removal and sidewalk contracts. So that's one place where we started. And the next part, we try to line up bribes he admitted to paying, when those happened, to what work he got. And then we're trying to figure out the money he admitted to paying, what he told the feds were bribes, where that money went.
Yeah. There's another contractor involved in this as well?
There is, a gentleman by the name of Charlie Richards.
And is he cooperating? Has he entered a plea at all?
He also entered a guilty plea back in February. He admitted to paying about $185,000 worth of money for bribes. And the way the scheme is laid out by the federal prosecutors is that Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Richards conspired to pay bribes under the belief that that money would go to an unnamed person. We don't know who that person is yet, or at least it has not been named by the feds. And under the belief that that money then went to other people with influence over the contracting process.
And so are we to think that this unnamed person was working in city government, or is this a person who had access to the gears of city government around contracting issues?
I think both are plausible.
Both are plausible. Mitzi Bickers.
Yes.
To what extent are the feds either sending out subpoenas for information on her and trying to get the various ends of her involvement in this and bring those together in the story?
We at the AJC, we've previously reported that the feds issued a subpoena to the city of Atlanta in August of last year seeking her records and work product during her time with the city. Separately, the federal government issued a subpoena to Clayton County, where she currently works now as a chaplain for Sheriff Victor Hill.
Okay. And that information, do we know whether or not she's responded, complied with the subpoenas?
We can only assume that she has. I will say, let me take a step back. The subpoenas were to the government, so the government has, because
yes.
We actually have obtained the work product of the lawyers for the two government agencies who replied to the subpoenas. So we have those documents.
And our timeline here, for everyone listening, we're essentially talking about a scandal that became public in January.
Correct.
So we're talking about a 7-month-long investigation at this point. That started before that, obviously, but it became public knowledge in January.
Yes.
What's your sense, even as you track the story, you don't have subpoena power, but as you're tracking and working the story, where do you think we are at this point in the story?
I think the feds are still building their case. We know that the feds were working with Mr. Mitchell as early as September 2015. That is when there was this apparent attempt to potentially try to silence him by an individual who threw a brick through his living room window and left dead rats on his property.
Wow.
And he informed the Atlanta police when he filed a police report that he was working with the feds on a federal case. So we think he was working with them going back that far. Since Mr. Mitchell pleaded guilty and since Mr. Richards pleaded guilty, there have been no other charges filed by the feds that we are aware of. It's possible that there are sealed indictments, that sort of thing, but we don't know of any charges. Nothing has been publicly announced. So I believe the federal government is still building their case against the so far unnamed parties who they believe might have taken bribes.
Okay, so let's talk about Mayor Reed here. Here he is responding to the scandal and whether he was involved.
I have never taken a bribe. And if you think that I would throw my life away for some short-term gratification, you don't know me well, and you don't know the plans that I have for my own life.
Any evidence at this point suggesting the mayor took a bribe, was involved in this mess at all?
None that we have seen, no.
But what's interesting is he's at the top of the food chain here. And it is a question I'm sure you've asked, because we're reporters and we always ask this question. What did he know and when did he know it? What's your sense of the answers to that?
Well, what's interesting is the clip that you played is essentially his answer to that very question.
Okay.
From the press conference, that clip was when the city released some 1.47 million pages of records in response to federal subpoenas. And in that press conference, the mayor adamantly denied taking a bribe or being involved, and he pledged his administration's cooperation with the federal government.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with AJC reporter Scott Truby. Scott, what was your reaction to that document dump? It's been criticized in some quarters.
Yes.
As being excessive and an attempt to slow down the investigation.
So our response as a newspaper was that everything should have been provided to us electronically from the start. Eventually, it was. Eventually, the city did provide records electronically. I believe they have said that it's some 1.47 million pages in response to the initial open records requests and subpoenas. I believe they've said since that it's another several hundred thousand pages that have been released related to another individual, a gentleman by the name of Adam Smith, who was the city's procurement director. If you'll recall, he was fired in February on the same day that the feds came into his office and took his laptop and cell phone.
Why was he fired?
Well, the mayor's office has never said directly why he was fired. He was just let go the day that the FBI came into his office and delivered a subpoena.
So doesn't that, as a reporter, that sends up red flags, right? That sort of, it seems to me, opens up another line of questioning in inquiry.
Well, it certainly does. And one of the things that subpoena did was it had a different window of time in which it appeared the feds were looking at things going on in the city of Atlanta. That subpoena was looking for information from 2014 to 2016. If we recall, Mr. Richards and Mr. Mitchell, their alleged scheme was 2010 to 2015. So there's a little overlap, but it doesn't overlap in full.
So I want to play one more clip here from the mayor. This time he is addressing the release we just talked about it a moment ago of the city documents to the public.
This whole matter has been upsetting to me, but the notion that we were trying to keep something from the public was particularly upsetting to me. So as soon as we could, we did.
In general terms, what is your thinking on how the mayor has handled this scandal, his transparency throughout this process?
I mean, I think clearly, this has been a distraction for his administration in the final year, probably not something he wants to have to deal with in the final year of his administration. If you were to go to the mayor's side of things, I think they would say that they have been fully transparent to the media and to the public. From our perspective, you know, the document dump in February was a bit perplexing because a lot of the documents were unreadable. They were, you know, plenty of blank pages that seemed unnecessary to be printed out. From our perspective, from the counsel we received from our attorneys, it seemed that this could have been produced initially electronically in such a way without sort of the theater of a large room with hundreds of boxes.
It ended up being pretty incredible theater.
It did. It did. And it was an interesting experience to actually go through those documents. I think my hands are still healing from the paper cuts.
Well, Scott, let me ask you. I think if I were asking, you're a young guy, but if I was to ask this question of old school reporters, they might say to me, hey, we actually prefer to have the actual documents and flip the pages and look through and highlight and that sort of thing.
I mean, in some ways, the physical paper actually is beneficial. As you said, it is sometimes easier to flip through it. One thing that we tended to find within the documents that we found in that document dump, there was stuff there that seemed to not really be relevant to anything the feds were asking for. There were schedules for road paving that seemed to have no bearing upon the investigation. There was church bulletins and school lunch menus. So we're not sure why those were included. You know, I'll say that now that everything is electronic, we continue to go through things electronically.
So you've emailed questions to Ms. Bickers, Reverend Bickers, correct?
Yes.
And to her attorney.
Yes.
Give us a sense of what maybe a couple of questions on your mind, questions that you want answers to at this point.
Well, sure. I mean, some of the questions we asked were, you know, for them to explain their side of, you know, what some of these transactions were with Mr. Mitchell. I mean, you have $1.6 million worth of money that we're aware of that went to companies or to her personally. What was the purpose of those, you know, payments? Was she doing work for Mr. Mitchell and his company in some form or fashion? I mean, certainly it's not unusual for companies to have political consultants, to lobby government, to try to vouch for policy. But what were these payments actually for? In particular, one that appears to line up with one Mr. Mitchell said was a bribe.
Yeah.
Those questions we don't yet have answers.
Scott, appreciate it. Thanks for your time. AJC reporter Scott Truby, we've been chatting about the latest developments in the Atlanta City Hall bribery case. Again, appreciate it, Scott.
Thank you.
And just ahead on the program, the science of roller coasters. But first, Athens band 5-8 is back in action with a new album. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. 2017 marks 30 years since the Food and Drug Administration approved AZT, still the most effective drug to combat HIV and AIDS. The Atlanta Metro has one of the highest rates in the nation of new HIV diagnoses. Caleb Anderson knows firsthand what it's like to live with the disease. He's a sophomore at DePaul University in Indiana.
I remember the day I found out, my mom quivered over the phone. She said, the pediatrician wants you to come to the office immediately. My stomach felt like it was being flushed down the toilet. I had a routine physical the week before. The doctor noticed swollen lymph nodes around my neck and in my groin area. I felt dizzy standing up for more than 30 seconds. So we returned to the doctor's office after the call back. Changing in front of my mother that day seemed worse than any other day. First my hat, shirt, pants, and underwear. Every layer making me more vulnerable and accountable for whatever the news would be. I could see my mother and even my doctor, too, were on edge of erupting with emotion. I was forced to be strong for them. In tears, who has time for that? The doctor said my test came back positive for HIV. My mother broke into tears. Everything felt colder and I couldn't move, not even my face. My mind sped back to those nights of lust. I remembered every house, hotel, and condo I'd visited during the past 2 years. I had been trying to cope with my actions without being accountable for them. Now, I couldn't escape. That realization numbed me. Remembering every man I gave my body to consolidated my stillness. I was diagnosed less than 2 months before I was set to start college. Large doses of penicillin made it hard to eat. It felt like someone was inside of me pushing the food back up. I thought giving up and dying from this stigmatized virus would be easier than waking up each day to fight for my life. My mother stayed with me in the hospital for a week. Then she supported me through 2 weeks of home treatment. Her support inspired me to get better for my loved ones, even if I didn't feel worthy of living anymore. Two months later, I arrived to campus as a college freshman. I was 50 pounds heavier, with a 90-day prescription of meds and lots of angst. I had to remember to take my medicine, keeping me alive. I also had to make sure every meal was balanced and that I exercised regularly. This seemed tedious on top of adjusting to school, with its predominantly white spaces, rigorous courses, and a suffocating new social environment. I was afraid to take my medicine at dinner because I knew my friends would question me. Most of them were Black. I was aware of the stigma and stereotypes thrown on those in our community living with HIV. I'm gay and HIV positive. I knew my identity as a Black man would be under attack, so I struggled with being my authentic self in the first few months of college. But the more I accepted myself and my health improved, I started feeling comfortable taking my pills in front of my friends. One night at my crew's normal 7 o'clock dinner, someone new came and sat with us. I took my pill out, ready to take it. The new girl asked, "What do you take your medicine for, Caleb?" I told her, "I have HIV, and I swallowed the stigma along with my pill. I was finally able to open up to my friends, and I found support among them. The presidential election was a wake-up call. I realized I needed to be strong, not just for myself, but for all people of color. I started hosting workshops on sex positivity and healthy relationships. I also decided to run for a seat on student government. Other students of color were also mobilizing. We collaborated to reach voters and get people out to debates. That's how we made history. People of color are now in the majority of our executive board for student government. My story is one of redemption and victory, not shame. I went into college thinking I'd be dead by the end of my first semester, and I still wake up each day reminding myself, I'm worthy of living, and so are you.
That was 19-year-old Caleb Anderson. Caleb wrote a version of the story for Vox Teen Communications and Atlanta Magazine. To remind himself to take his medication, Caleb sets his phone alarm to Magnolia. That's by Playboi Carti.
In New York, I'm Millie Rock. Hiding in my socks. Running from an op. And I shoot at op. What? And I'm on the block.
If you follow the Athens music scene, you almost certainly know about 5'8", founded in the early 90s. The band was on its way to success, following in the footsteps of groups like Pylon and REM. But personal issues and disagreements with the record company tore the band apart. An upcoming documentary called 5'8", Weirdo Reborn, tells the story of their reunion and their comeback. The band has a new album. It's called Songs for St. Jude. It drops this week. And with me now from Athens are band members Mike Mantione and Sean Dunn. Guys, good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to have you on the program. Yeah, pleasure. Hey, Mike, let me start with you. Look, I watched the documentary last night, and I love the part where you're talking about the success you were having back then. What was it, 20, 21 years ago or so? You were young. You were making music. You were part of the band. You were traveling around the country playing clubs. Talk about those days and how heady they were for you.
It was awesome. We were on a small independent label, and we were selling out the 40 Watt. And it was just a really great time for the band. At one point, Walter Yetnikoff, the president of CBS Records, flew me up to New York and wined and dined me. I got to meet Kate Moss, and it was pretty awesome. Went to some big party. They drove me around in a Silver Shadow limousine. Yeah, it was great.
Was there?
I heard all about that.
Yeah, see, Sean, was there anything that you thought you couldn't do, couldn't accomplish in those days if you're riding around with Kate Moss and getting all this high-end treatment?
There was a lot. Mostly it revolved around cleaning my bedroom. was unable to clean my bedroom. I couldn't understand it.
I want to play a clip from, I actually want to play a clip from the documentary. Again, it's called 5'8", Weirdo Reborn. This is David Barbee, a legendary Athens music producer, and your producer on the record.
And for the record, it's like I've made like 300 records. Nobody calls me before the record from the record company and says, so what kind of album do you hear the band making? But pressure. So we got in the studio to record, and Patrick gets sick. That didn't make it easier. Sean's brand new. He doesn't know the songs. There's some inner band strife.
So, Sean, what was going on? You didn't know the music. This is your moment. You're going in and you're recording what's going to be a big record for you guys.
Well, let me just be clear. Now, usually by the end of playing those songs live, I know the entire song and I know the changes by the end of the song.
That's
normally.
That's generous.
Normally.
That's generous of you. We're a very improvisational band, to say the least. I think David Barbee was taking a little bit of liberties right there. You know, I think Sean...
I knew some of the songs.
You knew a couple of songs. You might have... And you actually knew some parts that I still don't know and didn't know at that time.
That is true.
They showed up on the record, especially on karaoke.
Oh, they were good.
Yeah,
that's good.
I never heard that before. That was really a good part.
So, Sean, what was happening, David also alludes to internal strife within the band. What was happening within the band at this moment in time?
Yeah, I don't actually have any recollection of that. I'm a middle child, and I'm sort of conflict-averse, so I just shut down emotionally if anything like that was going on. So I couldn't tell you.
So, Mike, you take that on, yeah.
I know what was happening. We had been traveling around in a small green van, playing to about 30 people all across the country, doing about 250 dates a year for 2 years in a row. We were about done with that.
It was fun.
It's hard to overstate how much time we spent together. And
why is Sean laughing?
No, I remember it as a great time, but I just gloss over everything.
You remember that same period of time differently?
No, we did have a good time. That is true. I think the strife came from the pressure from the record company having to make the record.
Okay, so let me move forward and to that point about pressure. I want to play another clip from the documentary. This is Dan Horowitz, your bass player, talking about his discrepancy. Is the name correct, Dan Horowitz?
No.
I was just busting.
Oh, okay,
chunks.
Okay.
Pay no attention.
All right, talking about the issues with your record company at the time.
In hindsight, we can say, yeah, they wanted a really big rock record, and that's why they did the post-production stuff they did to the album. But I'm not sure if that was really so articulated before we started recording.
So, Mike, this is amazing to me that you can take on what is at the time a huge, you expect it to be a life-changing project, right? And not be on the same page ultimately with your record label on the deliverables, right? Were you sending finished tracks to the label? Were they giving you feedback? Talk about that, please.
There was no communication whatsoever during the recording of the record and the record label.
Correct.
We took the finished product and handed it to the label, and they freaked out.
And then the mayhem started after that. And we were already back in the van touring when that process of ruining the record began.
I see.
There was zero communication about what record they wanted us to make.
But they seem to suggest they wanted what kind of a record? A Nirvana-type record? And
yes.
You wanted to produce something that was true to your core, true to your spirit, that indie spirit.
Yeah, and I think I was a little surprised to hear that Barbee had gotten that conversation. And hats off to him for not bringing what he was getting from the record company into the studio, and especially in listening to the record now, you know, 16 years later, 21 years later, 22 years later. I think besides the weird mastering thing that happened with it, the record really holds up, and I would say a good part of that is because Barbie kept us on track with helping us fulfill our vision.
I want folks to hear a bit of it from the original Weirdo album. Let's play a bit of a track. This is What They Did. Sean, I think you just said it holds up. Mike, does it hold up for you?
It does. I was, you know, a lot of the story behind Weirdo, I had, you know, pleasantly forgotten. And when we all came back together to remaster it, it was basically because of, and really it was supposed to be remastering. It became a remixing. But Patrick had written a letter saying he wanted to right a wrong, and I didn't even remember. What had happened originally, and he wrote a letter to the band. This is Patrick Ferguson, the drummer, better known as Tigger. He wrote a really long letter. I read it, and I was like, what? And then it started coming back, and then when we went to Barbie, he was like, let's do it. And when having all of us together in the room listening to that record the way it was originally intended was just a super awesome experience. I can't even, I mean, it was like, wow.
That's wonderful.
It was just awesome. All of us, we had Demezy in there, and we were all listening to this song, Hurt You, which is just a really, I think, a really intense, one of my favorite songs I've ever written and the band has ever played together, and it was just, it's a slow song, it's a deep track. It was just mind-blowingly great.
And now you're back together. You've got new music. Sean, what are your thoughts on the new CD, Songs for St. Jude?
To me, it's the maybe the best record we've ever done. Just the way it came together. And again, I really think that the producer Mike Albanese, who's a local producer at a espresso machine studio here, he really helped us put it all together. We've been, Mike and I probably wrote close to 100 songs for this record.
My goodness.
And we, I feel great about it. I can't wait for everybody to hear it.
We should play a clip from the new album. This song is called Pleiades. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Pleiades.
Pleiades. Yeah.
Pleiades.
The sisters in the sky.
That's a constellation.
Constellation.
From Greek mythology, correct?
Correct. And there's a meteor shower that happens that sort of comes out of the Pleiades, which is making this song is making reference to.
Okay, let's play a clip. And Mike, last one from me. How does it feel to be back together? You've got the band back together again.
We're experiencing kind of a great time for the band. We really never broke up, essentially, but Sean and Patrick left the band at around 97, 98. And a friend of mine, Mike Rizzi, joined the band at that point, and we kept things rolling along, me and Dan. So really, next year, we'll be celebrating our 30 years of 5/8 continuously being together. But I've never felt better about what we're doing writing-wise. I think, you know, obviously having a double record tells you that we believe in what we're doing. But also, you know, we've already written the next record, I believe, and I'm getting ready to call up Albanese to get into the studio and start recording it.
Well,
so
It sounds like you're in a great place. It really does.
Yeah,
definitely.
And thank you for your time. No, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
I was going to just mention that we do have a pledge music drive for our album.
Pre-sale.
Yeah, it's pre-sale, so you can buy the album.
Guys, I've got to run, but thank you both very much. We're back in a moment. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Where were you 21 years ago when this happened to Atlanta? That's composer John Williams conducting Summon the Heroes during the 1996 Atlanta Olympic Games. Tomorrow we will look back at the games, and we want to hear from you. Were you there? We'd love to hear your memories. Give us a call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Next week, we broadcast from Macon's historic Douglas Theater. During the 1920s, the theater was an important venue for early African-American films. Over the years, black performers like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington graced the Douglas stage, playing what was called the Chitlin' Circuit. Alan Walden was a music manager who helped start Capricorn Records and who also managed Otis Redding. He says the Douglas played a vital role in Redding's success.
He always knew that he wanted to be a singer. I mean, from a little boy up. And Otis would only hold a job about a week, get his paycheck and change job the next week. But he always was singing. And the Douglas was a big one because it was one of the nicer venues that he played at the time. Not only that, but he rocked them when they were there. They used to call him Rock House Redding.
In a week, we will broadcast our show from the very stage where Otis Redding and many other legends performed. And you can join us on Thursday, July 27th at 7 p.m. Details at gpbnews.org.
We'll go to my brother.
Yesterday, Six Flags Over Georgia announced it will close a park landmark, the Georgia Cyclone Roller Coaster. This wooden giant will stop giving rides and bruising knees at the end of the month. This year is Six Flags' 50th anniversary, and plenty has changed since the theme park opened in 1967. But not the iconic Dahlonega Mine train ride. GPB's Ryan McFadden brings us this postcard from the tracks.
Welcome to Dahlonega Mine Train, where you must be at least 42 inches taller to ride. Please make sure you place all cups, bags, hats, and purses in the loose article being located towards your left-hand side.
I think actually me and my dad went here when I was like 12, so that was a long time ago. I think I was kind of scared at first, to be honest with you, but the Dahlonega Mine Train is a good place to start. It's kind of, you know, not too crazy.
I'm Gene Petriello. I'm the communications manager for Six Flags Over Georgia and Whitewater. I basically run all the media relations here at the parks.
A ski to a place where the fun never fades.
The coolest thing for me this year especially is hearing generations of families who said, I was here on June 16, 1967 and rode the Dahlonega Mine Train on its first day of operation. That family member is now riding with her or his grandkids and their children.
My name is Donitra and I'm from Atlanta. I'm with my 11-year-old daughter, Asia. What's one of our favorite rides here? What would you say?
The Skyscreamer.
Skyscreamer.
And the Dahlonega Mine Train.
This week is our Camp Mommy week, so she gets to decide wherever we go.
I like the roller coasters, and I like that it has a water park and roller coasters.
She keeps me in shape and young. It definitely reminds me of being a kid with my brother and my parents going to Six Flags in the summertime.
My name is Isaiah Webb, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
All right, tell me what your favorite ride is.
Ooh, the Blue Hawk. It's just so fun. You know, there's a lot of twists and turns, and it goes very fast. It's very fun.
Hi, I'm Jayla Stubbs, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. My favorite ride here is the Superman because I like being on my belly. I feel like it's really ingenuitive how, like, we're able to, like, you know, just feel like an actual superhero.
All attendants, all clear. All clear, ready for dispatch. You guys enjoy your ride.
All right, so we're about to go down the big, huge hill. Hopefully I don't drop the mic.
Oh, Jesus.
That's GPB's Ryan McFadden. And yes, his breakfast was where it began when his ride ended. Oh, my goodness. In America, we love our roller coasters. And here in Georgia, Six Flags is the go-to place for thrill rides. Joining us now to discuss the history of roller coasters and the appeal of getting your kicks on a ride is travel journalist Arthur Levine. Arthur, good to have you on the program.
Good morning, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning to you. When did you... You know, it's kind of a two-part question here. When did you fall in love with roller coasters? Let me start there.
Well, it began, like many folks, I suppose, it began when I was a little kid. I have lived nearly my entire life in Massachusetts, and as a very, very young child, my grandmother and my parents used to take me to a place called Revere Beach. It was kind of the Boston area's answer to Coney Island. Mm. And among my earliest memories is sitting on the beach. I must have been maybe, I don't know, two, you know, just the very earliest memories. Sitting on the beach, everybody's facing the ocean. I have my back to the ocean, and I'm looking at the rides. I'm looking at the wooden roller coaster, and I'm looking at the double Ferris wheel, and I'm just mesmerized by them. I was much too young to actually go on them, but I was fascinated by them at a very, very young age. And of course, as I got older, I did get a chance to ride them. And like most kids, I loved them, but unlike most adults, I guess, I just never lost my fascination with them and have been able to turn my passion into my profession. I now write about roller coasters and theme parks and amusement parks.
Oh, I want to get to that in a moment. But do you remember your first ride on a roller coaster? And do you remember the name of the coaster?
I believe it was at Revere Beach, and I believe it was the Wild Mouse, which there are many Wild Mouse coasters all over the country. These have the very tight hairpin turns. It looks like you're going to kind of go off the track. And I believe that that was my very first roller coaster, although there may have been some what we call kiddie coasters prior to that. Yeah. But that was sort of my first major coaster.
And what did you love about the experience?
What didn't I love about the experience? it was a chance to just sort of be in the moment and experience these crazy thrills that only a roller coaster can give you and feel out of control and yet completely safe at the same time. It was just a marvelous, wonderful feeling that I've wanted to repeat over and over, and it's been many, many years that I've been doing that.
How did you're doing what you love. How in the world did you turn this into a job so that you keep doing what you love to do again and again and again?
Well, it's sort of a long, convoluted story, but the short version of it is that I wanted to try to think of a way that I could get involved with the industry. A little tough being up here in Massachusetts. You know, the big parks are down closer to where you are in Florida and California. But I've always enjoyed writing and was able to turn my knack for writing into writing about the industry. And I began many, many years ago writing for a magazine that no longer exists called Theme Park. And then I had my own syndicated newspaper column that I called What's the Attraction? It was about theme parks and amusement parks. And more recently, I've been writing regularly for USA Today about theme parks and roller coasters and amusement parks, as well as Trip Savvy, which is an online travel network. I write about theme parks for them and many other publications and many other outlets.
So I want to talk about fear, because I have a lot of fear when it comes to roller coasters. This is Margie Kerr. She is a sociologist who studies fear. And here she is speaking at a TED Talk about fear.
What could possibly be fun about being scared? Fear has a bad rap, but it's not all bad. For starters, fear can actually feel pretty good. When a threat triggers our fight or flight response, our bodies prepare for danger by releasing chemicals that change how our brains and bodies function.
Are you ever afraid on a roller coaster?
Absolutely, and that's only natural. I'm glad you played that clip because I think that is probably the essence of what the appeal of roller coasters are. There's almost a primal urge that we have to experience this sense of fear. We're sort of hardwired, I think, to be hunter-gatherers, and yet in the modern world, you know, our meat comes shrink-wrapped at the grocery store. Yeah. There's no need for us to go on the hunt anymore. So we embrace experiences like roller coasters where we have this very physical reaction. You know, our pupils dilate and our breathing increases and our pulse rate increases and we release dopamine and adrenaline and we do have that fight flight syndrome as if we're kind of on the run, but yet we rationally understand that we're totally and completely safe, and yet our body senses this grave danger, so we have this physical reaction that some people, thrill junkies like myself, absolutely crave. Some people, of course, it's a bit too much. And for those people, I say, you know, don't get on a roller coaster. But there are quite a few people who love and appreciate that thrill, and I'm certainly one of them.
Don't get on a roller coaster. I feel like I was just scolded. So Arthur, look, are we totally and completely safe? You just mentioned it. Are we totally and completely safe?
It is perhaps the safest form of transportation that exists. You are much, much, much more safe riding on a roller coaster than you are driving in the car to and from the amusement park. There are all kinds of safety protocols and safety restraints and redundancies built into the rides to make them extremely safe. And so, yes, I think people can feel comfortable that they are in fact safe on roller coasters.
And Arthur, give us a bit of a brief history, if you would. When and where did we see the first coasters?
Well, it's a matter of some controversy. Controversy isn't the right word, but the issue isn't really settled. Some people think that this year we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of the roller coaster because in 1817 there were two rides that we would now think of as roller coasters, referred to as roller coasters, in Paris. They were gravity and people powered. They were wheeled carts on tracks, and they went down a hill, and people had to climb up to the passengers had to climb up to the top of the hill to get on them, and workers had to haul the carts back up to the top.
Oh my.
But it's significant to note that one of these rides was called the Russian Mountains. There may have been other wheeled coasters earlier in Paris or elsewhere in Europe, but we know for sure that in the 17th century there were Russian ice slides in Russia. And these were timber frames on the sides of mountains. They were about 70 feet tall. They were packed with snow. And they had small sleds. And people would just fly down the hill. And they were very popular especially among the aristocracy. And Catherine the Great actually enjoyed Russian ice slides and commissioned one for herself. So to this day, in other parts of the world, roller coasters are known generically as Russian mountains. And interestingly, in Russia, apparently, they referred to roller coasters generically as American mountains. So even though we do trace their origins back to Europe, even in Russia, there's an acknowledgement that there's something intrinsically American, all American about them. So that's sort of the very earliest records of roller coasters. In the United States, we go to the mid-1800s, and the very first U.S. roller coaster was the Mock Chunk Switchback Railway in Pennsylvania. It was actually a coal mining train, and early in the day it would be used to haul coal, and later in the day they would invite passengers on, and it was essentially just a runaway train that would just fly down the side of the mountain, and one of the cars had mules in it. And the mules would get out at the bottom of the hill and haul that train back up to the top, and that's how it would get up to the top. But the first sort of commercially successful roller coaster was at Coney Island in 1884. It was called the Gravity Switchback Railway, mm-hmm. and this was This was designed and operated by LaMarcus Thompson, who was known as the father of the roller coaster. It wasn't the very first roller coaster, but the first commercially successful one. And after entrepreneurs saw the success of this one at Coney Island, they began popping up everywhere. There were amusement parks and roller coasters all over the country, all over the world. And at one point, there were as many as 2,000 roller coasters in the early part of the 1900s, including in Georgia. There were there was a park known as Crump's Park, which was in Macon in the early 1900s. It had a wooden coaster. There was a park called Ponce de Leon in Atlanta, also in the early 1900s. And then there was Lakewood Park in Atlanta, which also opened in the early 1900s and closed in the 1970s. So perhaps some of your listeners are familiar with that park. And to this day, we have Lake Winnipesaukee on the Tennessee-Georgia line. That opened in 1925, and that is still operating today. And of course, we have Six Flags Over Georgia, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year.
And when did we seem to think that Six Flags is synonymous with coasters and theme parks? When did Six Flags essentially take that position?
Well, it was in the early 1970s that the first Six Flags opened in Texas, near Dallas, Six Flags Over Texas. Mm-hmm. And Six Flags is credited with sort of inventing the concept of the regional theme park. Disneyland opened a few years earlier. And I'm sorry, it was the early 1960s, not the 1970s, the early 1960s, that Six Flags Over Texas opened, and they invented the concept of the regional theme park.
Yes.
Disneyland had opened a few years earlier in the mid-1950s, but Six Flags took the idea of let's have a local, regional, seasonal park. It was generally only open in the warmer months, and since they've opened, they have become synonymous with really thrills. They've kind of dominated the
landscape
when it comes to thrills and thrilling rides and roller coasters.
Arthur,
and Six Flags Over Georgia was the second Six Flags park.
Arthur, appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Theme park and travel journalist Arthur Levine. Arthur, thank you. And that
You're welcome.
Yeah, pleasure. That is our show for today. You can always reach us. We're at 404-500-9457, and you can post on Facebook or Twitter. On Twitter, we're at OST Talk. That's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.